This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Would you like to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call. 800-462-7413. A line is open now for you at 800-462-7413. Now, in addition to your calls, always some interesting research to talk about during the hour.
Yes, a bill that essentially is going to be introduced into the Mississippi legislature that says if you are too fat, you should not be served at a restaurant.
No fat people allowed.
That's right. No fat people allowed in Mississippi. Interesting concept.
And?
Which we will talk about. And we'll talk about the USDA and the recall of beef to make sure that our food supply, especially school lunch supply, is safe.
And a yummy recipe coming up.
Yes, a great recipe. Sausage stuffed peppers with zucchini. Usually, when you talk about stuffed peppers, you talk about a recipe that is not healthy. We are going to give you a recipe that is healthy. And whenever I have stuffed peppers, I think of Mom.
She gave you stuffed peppers?
Yeah, but they weren't.
My mom never heard of stuffed peppers. 800-462-7413, toll free. Don't forget our medical Mythbusters coming up later on in the hour. A listener joins in now, Zorba, in Bozeman, Montana. Hi.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Zorba. Very nice to talk with you.
How can we help you?
I came across a very nice book, and I believe you might know about it. It's called You, the Owner's Manual by Mehmet Oz and Michael Roizen. I like that one very much. It seems to me it's a great guide for people. They have another one called You, Staying Young, which I've read and liked a lot as well. They do make one suggestion that I wanted to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
They're recommending to avoid aluminum because of the danger of it having some connection with Alzheimer's. That's interesting to me because my grandfather died of Alzheimer's, and I remember how difficult that disease was. So I'd like your opinion on that question.
Sure, you bet. They're wrong. That's my opinion, and I'll tell you why. And by the way, I think the book is great. But like all books, you know, there's no book that I've ever read when I think about it. Is there any book? Probably no book I've ever read which I've agreed with 100% of everything in the book. So
Read your book.
That's right. I've read
my
book.
You agree with everything
in your
book.
Yes, I do. Boy, you caught me on that. That's exactly it. But here's the issue with aluminum. We have found aluminum in the plaques and tangles of the brains of people with Alzheimer's. And by the way, my mom had Alzheimer's, so it's not a small issue. It's a big issue. And aluminum is the most common metal element on Earth. Aluminum is extremely common, and it's the most common thing that's used in cookware because it's lighter weight than using cast iron. We use a lot of cast iron in our house because it's a good way to get iron. But frankly, aluminum is the way to go. So the FDA and the USDA and the NIH have been very, very interested in this for a number of years. They've said, and I think very scientifically shown, that this just happens to be in the brain, in the plaques and tangles, but it's not the issue. The predominant thought within Alzheimer's today is that this is inflammation of some sort. And then something called amyloid is laid down over that over the area of inflammation. And if we could control the amyloid and the inflammation, we might control the Alzheimer's. And that's kind of the predominant theory from my read. But I don't think you have to worry about it.
Well, how do we know for sure, though?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? How do we know for sure? Well, right. You got to look at the balance of evidence that's in there, you know. And if you're concerned, you don't have to cook in aluminum. You know, you can cook in cast iron. You don't need aluminum to cook. You don't have to. It's not essential. And some people don't cook in aluminum because they are concerned.
But you, with your family history, you're still using
aluminum. I don't worry about aluminum at all. I don't worry about it. Dutch study shows anti-inflammatories may cut the risk significantly. The data is still out on it, but the study shows that literally two Aleve tablets, generic Aleve, once a day may actually cut your risk of getting Alzheimer's if you're predisposed by maybe 20 to 30%. Big thing. Multivitamin. If it says multivitamin USP, it has folic acid and B12, that may cut the risk of Alzheimer's also. And those are the things that I do. And I take an aspirin tablet a day, keep your blood pressure under control, because that's a cause of dementia, and less than two alcoholic drinks a day. All those things will reduce your risk of either Alzheimer's or multi-infarct dementia, small strokes to the brain, which is half of all dementia that we see. It's half Alzheimer's, half multi-infarct.
Thank you very much. I was a little concerned, and with respect to your suggestion of less than or two or fewer alcoholic drinks per day,
yeah.
This way, I guess, as I understand it, I have the green light to drink beer in cans.
You betcha!
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for the call.
A brewski from the can.
800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi.
Zorba and Tom, thanks so much for taking my call. My husband and I just love your show.
Oh, thank you so much. We appreciate the call. How can we help you?
Well, I just have a question about croup. I have a 3-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter. And I'm wondering why it is that when they both seem to get the same cold, for my daughter, it turns into croup. But for my son, it just remains a cold, sometimes nasty, but it can just remain a normal cold, whereas she gets, you know, the wheezing and the difficulty breathing and the barky cough and things like that.
Oh, sure. How old's your son? How old's your daughter?
My son is 3, mm-hmm. and my daughter is 2.
Uh-huh. Cute.
Yeah, they are.
History of asthma in the family?
No.
No history. No smoke in the environment. You're a public radio listener, so it's not possible for you to smoke cigarettes in the house.
Absolutely not.
That's right. Well, you can't listen to public radio smoke cigarettes. It's not allowed. The cigarette companies don't want you to have it, that's for sure. They don't want public radio listeners on their roll. They just cause trouble and mischief. and mischief when it comes to, you know, bands and public places, you know, those public radio people.
Oh, sure.
Basically, it's sort of the response your daughter you said is the one who gets the croup.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Just has hyperactive airways. That's all, and she'll grow out of it. And it's the same. It's this probably exactly the same viral infection. Just like some kids seem to get ear infections, some kids may have more diarrhea. There, she just has a hyperactive airway. Now, why she has it, I don't know. Often, if there's a family history of asthma, that could be the precursor to asthma. But her airways are hyperactive, and over time, she'll probably stop getting croup. That's just what we see.
At about what age, if you don't mind me asking, do you see this kind of starting to slow down?
Well, certainly before, it's usually before the age of 5, but it's quite variable. Could be 6 months from now, could be a year from now. The kids who just seem to get croup all the time, which is caused by a variety of viruses, and then a year later, 2 years later, they don't seem to get it at all. So there will be a time at which she just won't get it, and then you'll say, gosh, she's had a lot of colds and she's not wheezing. And that's when you know it goes away. But I can't predict it exactly.
So is croup necessarily a particular virus?
Well, it is a reaction to a viral infection. And some viruses are more likely to produce it than others.
Okay.
The RSV virus, for which we actually have immunizations, is just a more likely to cause a croupy type cough and make children and adults, if they get it really, really sick, like influenza. Influenza, of course, can also do it, which is why kids who get this are now often recommended now to get immunizations for influenza. But anyway, proper immunization, make sure you tend to croup, and the reality is they're just going to get all these colds because that's what kids do.
Yeah, absolutely. Zorba, I have one last question, actually. Why is it that I have been told, and both of them work, to take her outside in the cold, dry air?
Because we live in the state of Wisconsin. And we don't have warm, moist air. But cold, dry air often is just better. It just helps with kids.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
I really appreciate all your help.
Thanks a lot for the call. Talking about smoking and public radio, it occurs to me, my cousin John Pearson listens to public radio and smokes cigarettes.
Uh-huh. Oh, I can't believe it. I just can't. Well, he's one.
And if
that's
he had,
the one
and if he had to give up one or the other.
Yeah. Oh, no. We're not going to make people do that.
Guess which one.
We're not going to do that. No, let me ask you a question, though. He donates. He contributes to public radio money, right? Then we don't ask him to give up his cigarettes.
800-462-7444. 413. Tell us about the Mississippi proposal, Zorba, to ban fat people from restaurants.
Well, the Mississippi proposal is if you are overweight, this is in Mississippi, you know, just like the trans fats in New York City, let's get the trans fats out of there, which
Isn't
turns
Mississippi
out to be okay.
Now the, one of the most overweight states?
Absolutely. They're number one.
I think they're number, yeah.
We used to be number two. Now we're like number 20 in Wisconsin. We have fallen way behind on the obesity. Actually, people have caught up to us and done a better job than we did because of Mississippi.
Yeah, right.
And Mississippi. So this is very interesting. Mr. John Reed of Gautier, Mississippi. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing. And 30% of the people in Mississippi are obese. Yeah. Not overweight, obese.
Obese.
It means a BMI greater than 30. That's 30%.
Yeah.
And Mr. Gautier happens to be 5'11 and clocks in at 230 pounds himself. But he believes that there should be a bill placed in front of the legislature that says if you go to a restaurant and you're too fat, basically, that they should not serve you.
To be fair, he doesn't really think this is going to become law.
Well, you never know with these legislators.
Well,
he said he doesn't, but he's trying to make a point. That's right. He certainly did make a point. He's trying to make a point that just like, you know, you had too many drinks and we're not going to serve you at the bar. You've had too many calories. We're not going to serve you at a restaurant. But I think he's making a point. And I'll tell you something interesting. I happen to go to a lot of different things. And I do go. One of the places that I go to is Subway. It just happens to be a place I go. It's near my office, and I try to get a heart-healthy sandwich. And I was standing in there, and I looked at some people in front of me. This is, you know, probably, this is the other day. And I looked at them, and they clocked in at between 275 and 325 pounds, I'm sure. I've got a good eye for weight. Yeah. I can't tell age. And I just wanted to see what they ordered. And kind of hanging out, you know, looking at there. Number one, they had a foot-long sub. They had double cheese on the sub, okay? Yeah. They had the regular meat on the sub. Then for the dressing, they put on mayonnaise. And then they said, oh, no, that's not enough. And they put on more mayonnaise. And I looked at the sandwich and I thought, this is about a 1,500-calorie sandwich. Now, the issue is I don't think the people who were there eating their sandwich knew it was 1,500 calories. I don't think people have insight into the foods that are put on because they're not basically placed up there because they dissuade people from eating and they don't know, you know, how the food is. And his absurd idea that you don't serve people who are overweight is clearly absurd, but we ought to be able to tell people how many calories there are in food in some way in a restaurant. Right now we don't do it. You can't tell by eyeballing.
Well, in a way, he's accomplished his point here or his goal.
Okay.
But we're talking about this on the radio.
Yes, we are.
And other people are talking about it, too, because it's such a kind of ridiculous idea. You can't ban overweight people from restaurants.
Absolutely.
But by proposing that, he makes his point.
It's a modest proposal.
A modest. 800-462-7413. And a listener in Knoxville, Tennessee with us now. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. It's kind of a dilemma. My husband and I are both avid bicyclists. And a couple of years ago, he was diagnosed with sick sinus syndrome and had a racing heart. So we had to have a pacemaker put in, which has been great. But came up to the point where he was starting to exercise again and was not having a good experience because the pacemaker would start to try to control his racing heart that would happen when he was exercising. So he went back to the cardiologist and had them recalibrate the pacemaker so he could exercise because we definitely want to continue our lifestyle. The problem now is when he's not exercising and he goes over like a pothole in the car or, you know, a bumpy road, his pacemaker thinks he's exercising and it starts not controlling the racing heart. So then he gets dizzy. So my concern is there anything he can do to kind of prevent that from happening without having to reset back to the pre-exercise, non-exercise setting?
Sure. I understand what you're talking about. Well, a couple of issues, first of all. Sick sinus syndrome is when your pulse is too low. So you get dizzy, and a pacemaker is put in to be able to make the pulse at the proper rate. And it means that the sinus node, which actually tells the heart to have a beat, isn't working properly. And pacemakers are really wonderful. They fix this, basically. And people who are dead are now alive. And there are many different kinds of pacemakers where they're programmed, and they're demand pacemakers that only kick in when they need to, and then there are pacemakers that are basically doing the work all the time. They're kind of, you know, they're programmed to listen to the heart and see what's happening and then put it in. And it sounds like his pacemaker is responding in an aberrant way. Now, a racing heart is totally different. Is he on a beta blocker at all?
Yeah, he actually is on Sotalol and an aspirin. Those are the only medications.
So what you have to do is this. First of all, you haven't discussed this with his cardiologist.
I'm not sure whether he's done that, because he just started telling me that he's getting dizzy when he drives.
Okay, so he doesn't suffer from the stubborns, does he?
Yeah.
He does. yeah, insightful, aren't I? Yeah. He's a guy who suffers from the stubborns, and I'm okay, honey, don't worry about it. Life will be fine. So the first thing you got to do is cure the stubborns, and you do this through interaction with him. He's like, come on, let's talk about this to the cardiologist. You know the cardiologist, right? You've met, met the nice person? You like the cardiologist?
Yeah, he seems like a really nice person. Okay. He seems like he's like the head of the cardiology department.
Well, head is one thing that may be an issue. You know, is he good enough and does he put it in properly? But having enough time for your husband is the other issue, so that you can fine tune it. And what happens is he's got to have this altered so that it works for him. And it's basically a pacemaker issue or a beta blocker issue. So it's either the beta blocker he's taking, the amount of beta blocker on one hand for the racing of the heart, that's a different issue, or the pacemaker if it's kicking in. And so the cardiologist is really the chief of staff for your husband at this time. And sometimes the thing you've got to sit down and talk with your husband about, do it a nice way, maybe over dinner with a little nice wine, some candlelight, and you say, honey, I want you to have a good relationship, not just with me, but with your cardiologist. And that back and forth relationship really will make a difference, because sometimes you've got to talk to them, and then it's not exactly this way. And sometimes it takes 5 or 6 adjustments to get to the right adjustment between the beta blocker and the pacer. But that's where you come in. You got to convince your husband to do it. And you also have to convince him to complain is not a bad thing. In other words, he's not a bad patient if he complains about something. He's a good patient because he's bringing up what needs to be done.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You live in a fairy tale world.
Yes,
is
I
that
do.
The way
yes,
Penny yes, deals yes, with you? Hi, honey. Here's some wine. Light the candles. I'd like it. Where did you come up with that?
I don't know. It just came from my head. That's
in
right.
your dreams.
Came in my dreams.
How long have you been married?
In my dreams, yes. Before over 30 years.
Before we get to the break, Zorba, let's try something a little different. From time to time, we need to clear up some room in our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. So it's time for a lightning round of questions from listeners. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Kate in Jacksonville asks, is it a good idea to take Tums even if you don't have heartburn, but just as a calcium supplement?
But of course, and I like the Tums that are flavored because they are colorful.
Aha. Phil in Mountain Home, Arkansas asks, can you get vitamin D from a tanning bed?
Absolutely. But you know what you also get from a tanning bed?
Sunburn.
And cancer. Next question.
All right. Lucy in Black Creek, Wisconsin writes, is it possible for germs to live on a chapstick or a jar of Blistex so that the next time you use it, you can catch another cold?
Germs live everywhere.
How long do they live?
Forever.
They do not.
No, they don't.
How long do
you
they
can't,
live?
They're always around. You really cannot get a germ from a Blistex. You can't get a cold from a Blistex. But if you took the Blistex, it's not sterile, so that means there are germs around, but they're not going to cause you any problem. Don't be a germaphobe, Lucy.
Finally, Alan in Red Lodge, Montana would like to know why his nose drips constantly only when he's hiking.
Often because of an exaggerated adrenal response, because the air is dry. There's a prescription spray called Atrovent that you spray in your nose, and he should be happy that his nose doesn't get longer because he's telling the truth.
Aha. Uh-huh. Get your question in for our next lightning round by sending us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. You'll want to stay tuned for that. It's a yummy one. Also, a little later, our medical myth buster and lots more of your questions for Zorba here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls at 800-462-7413 after we're done with our recipe, which is coming up right now. Sounds delish. Zorba sausage stuffed peppers with zucchini.
It absolutely is a fabulous recipe. Now, I happen to like stuffed peppers. Do you like stuffed peppers?
I do like stuffed peppers, yeah.
And my mother used to make a mean stuffed pepper. I mean, that's what she would do. Did your mom do that?
They weren't invented when my mom...
They weren't invented. You mean the green pepper hadn't been invented
right.
yet, or the stuffing?
I don't think anybody, at least in our town, had stuffed a pepper when I was a kid.
Pepper. But I love stuffed peppers, and I periodically, when I go back to my hometown of Chicago, we'll go to a place called Francis's Restaurant, which is on... near Diversity Street in Chicago, on Diversity right near Fullerton, and I'll have a stuffed pepper because it reminds me of Mom. But the problem with stuffed peppers is they're made with ground beef, they're made with rice, and they have an element of grease.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they have an element of grease. So you want to make a healthy stuffed pepper. This is a healthy stuffed pepper because it doesn't use ground beef. It doesn't use rice, and there's a way to get rid of the grease beautifully within the pepper. And you can have a healthy pepper. And when we're done, we'll compare this and contrast this to a healthy traditional stuffed pepper, and it has less oil than that does.
Okay, let's do it.
It's a great recipe. So start out with a half pound of sweet Italian turkey or chicken sausage, and you remove the casing. So you take the sausage and, you know, you squirt it out of the casing.
Got it. A half a pound of sweet Italian turkey or chicken sausages, casings removed.
That's right. Very easy to do, and it's a way to, you know, you can look at it and make it, you know, they tend to be low-fat because people who buy turkey and chicken sausage often want a low-fat product. But that's really what you're looking for. So the next step is a quarter of a cup of fresh mushrooms that you chop.
A quarter cup of fresh mushrooms chopped.
So once again, within this dish, that's going to give you some of the taste and the texture that you normally would get from rice. Coarsely chopped zucchini, three quarters of a cup, or chopped zucchini. Just chop it up.
Three quarters of a cup of coarsely grated or chopped zucchini.
Remember, again, this is sort of the rice substitute, if you will, a healthier way of looking at it. A quarter cup of finely chopped red onion.
Quarter cup finely chopped red onion.
2 TBL of fresh parsley.
2 big T fresh parsley.
And you mince that. You want to mince the fresh parsley.
Okay.
2 tablespoonfuls of fine, fine breadcrumbs. You know, nice breadcrumbs.
2 big T. What do you mean, nice breadcrumbs?
Well, one of the things that I find is I often will have breadcrumbs in the house, and I don't use very much of them, so I'll have the container there for years. That's what it seems like. And I think to myself, why do I have this thing there for years? And I think periodically in your pantry, you've got to replace the breadcrumbs, because if they're old, they don't taste very good. They become stale. So little small containers of breadcrumbs, and you can buy better breadcrumbs, cheaper breadcrumbs. I like to buy fine breadcrumbs.
Okay.
One egg. A half teaspoon of black pepper.
Half a little tea, black pepper.
Pinch of salt.
A pinch of salt.
Quarter teaspoon of minced fresh rosemary, if you can get it.
Quarter little tea, minced fresh rosemary.
If
hard
you can
to get
it. Well, sometimes you can get it. Sometimes it's there. And if not, then just add a little bit more parsley. You could also add basil if you wanted to. You can really add any kind of an aromatic herb that's fresh that's around. But parsley will work okay for this. And then 2 medium bell peppers. Reds are preferred. So, of course, they're more expensive often, you know, if they're out of season. But greens are also okay. And you're going to cut them in half, take the seeds out, okay? So
2 medium bell peppers cut in half. Of course, you always take the seeds out.
Yeah, I take the seeds out. Yeah. Well, that's what you have to do. And, you know, you're going to take off the, as I said, cut in half. And then a Parmesan cheese to dust.
Ooh, That's dusted right. with Parmesan cheese.
That's right. So here's how we make it. Preheat the oven to 350. Then, in a large bowl, combine the sausage, mushrooms, zucchini, red onion, parsley, breadcrumbs, eggs, salt and pepper, and rosemary. Mix it well. Fill the pepper halves. You know, you've got two halves on each pepper with the mixture equally. Now, here's the trick. Poke holes into the bottom of the peppers and arrange them on the broiler pan. You're going to put them on the broiler pan. And the reason is, any of the oil, the grease that's in there, will drain out of the pepper through the hole.
Oh.
So it has less oil in it. Bake the peppers uncovered for 1 hour or until the tops are nicely browned. You don't broil them. You put them in a broiling pan, but you're baking them till the tops are browned, and then dust the top with Parmesan cheese.
We have them in front of me. Usually, I think grease is kind of one of the nice things about them. You don't have the grease with these peppers.
There's
and they
no
still taste
about.
Good? Well, let me try. Let me try. I'll be the judge of this.
What do you think?
Too big a bite.
It is too big a bite. Yeah, I think you're a slob there, but it's too big a bite.
This is delicious.
Isn't it delicious? It's delicious. It really is good. And it's not as greasy. Now, when you compare this, when you look at the comparison, which I always like to do, it's 200 calories. That's all. 200 calories a serving. Now, if you go on the web, which we did, and you look at a healthy, traditional beef and rice stuffed pepper, what we found is generally they were about 400 calories. So these are half the calories of the normal pepper. And not only that, when you look and say, what's the difference is in the fat. A traditional recipe that's heart healthy, has been limited, has twice as many calories as our sausage stuffed pepper with zucchini.
This is
a great recipe.
Delicious.
Absolutely delicious. You got to try it.
Adam
if you're
Friedrich,
a pepper fan.
Our producer, cooked it up to perfection.
Absolutely. If you are a pepper, if you are a stuffed pepper fan, this recipe
is for you. You're not, this is, anyway, we're happy to send you the recipe. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706. Don't forget to include a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope. We'll send it along to you.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can get this recipe and you can sign up for our podcast.
(800) 462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Back to the phone, Zorba, and a listener with us now in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, I was listening to your show a while ago, and I caught the end of a segment where someone called in about having problems with dairy and that it made them sick, sort of got like flu-like symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
I have actually had a problem with dairy for about 23 years now. When I was in the eighth grade, I was a wrestler and would get nosebleeds all of the time. So I went to a sports medicine doctor, and he asked me if I got sick a lot. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, do you drink a lot of milk? And I said, well, about a half gallon a day. He said, well, quit drinking milk and the problems will go away. I quit drinking milk. And I no longer got sick, and I was usually sick like 4 to 8 weeks a year, and I stopped getting the nosebleeds. From the time I was 14 till about 30, I slowly had to eliminate all dairy, including cheese, because I got more and more sensitive to it and would sort of play around with the limit on it.
Sensitive to it in what way? The same way?
Well, what would happen is basically every time I have too much dairy, I basically get like a combination between like strep throat and flu, and I'm sick for about 2 weeks. And I've played around with it trying to do more dairy, but every time I do it, I end up getting sick. And so now I know that like I can have one bag of M&Ms and I'll be all right, but if I have two, I'll end up getting sick.
Now, wait a minute. You know, I have to tell you, I don't think of M&M's as a dairy product. I mean, I come from the state of Wisconsin. I live in the state of Wisconsin. We've got lots of farms here. And usually farmers, if I talk about dairy, they tend to think about milk and cheese and yogurt and butter. I have to tell you, M&M's are way down the road in terms of a dairy product. Now, they might be part of the four basic food groups, chocolate, sugar, starch, and grease. But on the whole, I don't think
well,
so.
It might not. It might be. That may have been a bad example, but you know,
a bad example.
If I have a cheese curd.
Well, cheese curds would be there.
Yeah.
So in other words, when you have dairy products, you feel ill. Is that what happens?
And it takes about 2 to 3 days for it to sort of kick
sure,
in.
Sure. Have you ever used Lactaid, by the way?
I haven't.
Uh-huh. You probably have. First of all, let's talk about the nosebleeds.
Yeah.
Here it was. You're a wrestler. You get nosebleeds. That was a few years ago. That might have been more related to dry weather. Buffalo does get dry in the wintertime. Even though you have lots of snow, it's actually deserty. It's not really a very moist environment. Moist environment. And often that's when wrestling tournaments occur.
But he stopped the milk and the nosebleeds.
Yeah, it's hard for me to connect that together. But it's not hard for me to connect together the fact that whenever you have dairy, you don't feel good. That makes a lot of sense. And that sounds to me like lactose intolerance. Mm. And it's a funny thing. Lactose intolerance can be a genetic issue. For instance, much more common in African Americans than in Asians. Europeans are much less likely to be lactose intolerant, although a certain percentage of them are. I can't quite remember exactly what the percent is, but it's pretty high. It's related to how much you have. So some people can tolerate, for instance, a cheese curd, but can't eat half the bag or a quarter of the bag. Some people can eat yogurt, which is sort of not exactly partially digested, but some people will tolerate yogurt, but they can't eat ice cream or drink milk. And Lactaid, which happens to be in a generic also, is basically an enzyme that goes in the stomach when you have the dairy product. And for some people, that makes the difference.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't really have any of the symptoms of lactose intolerance. I don't get gassy.
But you don't feel good.
I get like a strep throat, though. Right. Like all my mucous membranes are affected.
Well, you, first of all, this is you. Like you said, you may not have traditional lactose intolerance with the bloating stomach and you just, you know, as you feel kind of yucky. But for some people, they just feel like they're sick and they're ill. So, but let me ask you a question. Do you like dairy products? Do you want to go back to dairy products?
Or? I love them.
You love dairy products.
But I get sick every time I eat them.
Yeah, well, a couple of suggestions. Number one, try Lactaid. That's what I would do. I would go get the generic Lactaid or the name brand. I would try it and see whether or not it works. Then number two, find out if there's a difference. So, for instance, yogurt, cheese, milk, ice cream. Separate them out. Have some Lactaid. See if you tolerate yogurt. You may tolerate a small container, but not a large container. For ice cream, you may tolerate a scoop, but not two scoops. In other words, number one, it may be the type of dairy product, and number two, it may be how much. And if that fails, I would recommend that you buy the vegan cookbook and go that route, because basically your body is just saying it can't tolerate it.
Okay.
That's what it is. But I would try the enzyme. So, well, sorry to hear that. You know, we in the state of Wisconsin hate it when people cannot eat dairy. And let me tell you, I am now going to think of M&Ms as part of dairy whenever I have an M&M.
There you go.
Thanks for the call.
All right.
Bye-bye. Whenever we talk about this issue, Zorba, I think of my Aunt Marie, may she rest in peace.
Oh, God bless her.
Who could not tolerate any dairy products except for...
Yes.
Guess.
Cheese?
Ice cream.
Ice cream.
Somehow ice cream was just fine.
Ice cream. Here we go.
800-462-7413, toll free. Zorba, let's grab a quick question before the break. This one comes to us from Melissa in Red Bank, New Jersey. Melissa would like to know how long a hard-boiled egg is good for after it's been cooked.
Well, you mean how long it tastes good? You know, how long it can be in the
refrigerator?
It's good
before it hurts you, before it's bad for you.
That's a fascinating question. Well, once you cook it, it basically is now a cooked item. So I generally think of them as good as for 3 to 5 days in the refrigerator. But frankly, maybe it could last even longer than 3 to 5 days. Because sometimes I go to the store and I buy the quick store and I buy hard-boiled eggs. And they have an out date, when I think about it now, of 2 weeks from the time that I buy them. Because I often will have a hard-boiled egg for breakfast that I buy at my local gas station. Gosh, you go to the gas station and buy eggs. But I do. I go and get gas, I get hard-boiled eggs, and my other favorite breakfast food that we will not discuss at this moment.
It says they're good for 2 weeks?
Yeah. Well, the store I go to, you mean they're not good for 2 weeks?
I don't know.
Well, that's what they say. They're good for 2 weeks, but who knows when they make them? They could make them months ago.
Well, next time you do that, put it in the refrigerator or get an extra one.
Okay.
And then 2 weeks later, eat it.
Yeah.
And
well, then come back. But I don't like to do that. I don't want to eat
and then come back to the show
good.
And tell us whether
thank
you're
you.
Sick or
thank
not.
You, Tom. Thank you. Got it.
We like hearing from you. Send us your questions, comments, and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up, and we have our medical myth buster as well here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Remember that number, 800-462-7413. Whenever you have a health or fitness question for Zorba Pastor. But before we get to our phones again, Zorba, we haven't talked about that beef recall a while back, and it's been on my mind, a lot of people's minds. Where was the FDA during all of this process?
Oh, well, that's the million-dollar question. You know, as you remember, it wasn't the FDA that basically stepped in with this at all. It was somebody who went in with a camera and actually discovered that they were using downed cows. Now, here's the issue. Here's the food problem issue. Cows that are downed, cows that are forget the ethical issues of slaughtering, and that's a big, big, giant issue.
Sure.
Downed cows who do not walk, basically, to be slaughtered are cows that are at risk for having mad cow disease. You cannot put them in the food supply. That's the issue because you can't tell whether or not they've got it. And they were doing that. And so the fact is, you know, they say, well, there wasn't anything in the food supply. We know there wasn't anything there. We don't think there was anything there. They don't really know. And they don't know how long it's been going on.
Well,
and where were the inspectors?
A lot of the recalled beef was already consumed when they recalled
Absolutely. And it went into the school lunch program. And if you look at the data, and I was looking at the data about this particular study, there are not a lot of beef processors that basically meet, quote, the federal guidelines to be able to use this in the school lunch programs and so on. And this company was one of the few companies, or just a handful of companies, that met the guidelines. Well, the fact is they weren't meeting the guidelines at all. And what was the government doing not discovering this, you know, this horrendous situation, both from an ethical point of view and from a point of view of poisoning the food supply for our children.
Well, what do we have, like 9 inspectors responsible for the whole country or something?
That's exactly what it is. What happens is the FDA and the federal government does not basically support the FDA by giving them enough inspectors to be able to go and look at it. And I think we need a whole overhaul on how we look at the food supply program in this country. Now, we've got a very safe food supply, and that's what everyone says. Our food supply is, you know, quote, the safest in the world. Well, I don't really believe that. I think that what we do is we need more inspectors who are trained properly, who go in random ways and basically look at the situation.
Well, we haven't heard about anybody really getting sick, though, from this beef that was recalled.
Absolutely the case. We haven't heard about anyone being sick, but we do know that from an E. coli point of view, and this was not an E. coli issue, from an E. coli point of view, we know there are lots of people that get sick and die from food poisoning, and we know that that's from basically tainted food that gets into the food supply. And so we need more FDA inspectors. We need the government to basically assure that we have a safe food supply. And I think this is a wake-up call for us to insist that our government support the FDA, putting more inspectors there so they can discover this versus somebody who comes in with a camera.
800-462-7413, toll-free if you have a question for Zorba, as does this listener in El Paso, Texas. Hi.
Hola, muchachos. ¿Cómo están?
Bien, muy bien.
Muy bien, gracias.
There you go. Muy bien, gracias. Dr. Zorba.
How can we help you?
All right. I've got to set this up for you guys, all right? I'm assuming you guys are pretty young, in your 20s and 30s.
Yeah, right. You got it. That's right.
Well, we're a bunch of old geezers that get together just about every day. We take a couple of days off during the week to work out, stuff like that. You know, we're trying to beat Father Time. But in El Paso, Texas, we're real close to the border, so we have curanderos and people that massage and all that. And, of course, you know, being old-timers, you can tell when you're around us because we all smell like Ben Gay or Atomic Bomb or, you know. We permeate for about half a mile away.
Uh-huh.
Well, as we're working out one day, one of my friends, Ernest, we all kind of smell and go, what do you smell like? And so we all know that we've smelled this before, and nobody can tell what it is. Well, lo and behold, my friend Ernest has put WD-40 on his elbows.
Oh, uh-huh, okay.
Because one of the local masseuse curanderos told him that it was very good for you for, like, when you have arthritis or when you're working out. And, you know, we all have that tennis elbow and every kind of elbow on this body that's 60 years old now. So we're all wondering, this can't be good for you.
Well,
so
why don't you guys tell me what WD-40 is?
Wait a minute. You don't know what WD-40
is?
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe it. Obviously, this is not somebody who does anything mechanical.
Well,
I do hardly anything.
You've never had a wrench in your life, then.
I mean, that's a WD-40 comes out of a little spray bottle, and it has
a
distinct odor to it, and it's an oil that you use for basically things that are stuck and rusted.
Well,
it's a nut, and it's a lubricant.
It's a lubricant.
Okay,
exactly.
All right.
This, yeah, I mean, and this is a whole other story. But let's get to the WD-40. The fact is, this is a remedy that had been used in the Midwest for many, many years.
Absolutely.
I knew a number of farmers, and when I first started practice, one of the ways you could tell they were using WD-40 is they had these stains on their overalls right at their knees. And you would see it, and they were oil stains. And they'd come in, for arthritis, and I'd say, are you using WD-40? And they'd say, how did you know? And that's because you saw oil stains in their knees because they were,
People are using lubricants to get rust off to ease their pain?
Right. That's exactly
it. It kind of makes sense. I mean, you're lubricating the joint.
But it actually doesn't work at all. And the problems, first of all, the problems really are the fact that if you are around oil all the time, if you get it, if you put it on your hands, you swallow it, if you inhale it, you can have problems because it's oil. It's basically a petroleum product. It does not get into the joint. It does not actually help arthritis at all. It has a smell to it, like you said, kind of like Bengay, kind of like Vicks, that sort of smell, but it's a distinct smell of WD-40, and it really doesn't work. And it's just what you said. It's not a great idea to rub on your body because it's oil. And you put it in your mouth and swallow it. It's not great.
When we were kids, we used to get kerosene to wipe off, like, paint and all that kind of stuff. And then we come up finding later on that we weren't supposed to be doing that. So I told Ernest, there's just no way you should be able to be putting oil in your body.
That's
so I'm
exactly
correct,
right.
And he's wrong.
You are right. He is wrong. Stick to the Bengay, and you'll be a healthier guy.
Thanks a lot for the call.
All right, guys. Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. That sounded like a medical mythbuster.
It almost did sound like a medical mythbuster. But I think the real mythbuster is that Tom Clark fixes anything at home. That's the mythbuster. You ain't Mr. Fix-It.
Well, let's get to our real medical mythbuster this time around. Today's myth comes to us from Rosanna in Wichita, Kansas, who writes, as a new nurse, I hear a lot of old wives' tales, but this one actually comes from my husband's family. They're from India. In his culture, babies' heads are shaved a few times during early childhood. My sister-in-law says that it's to make the baby's hair grow in thicker. Does shaving a baby's head really do anything to change how their hair will be in adulthood?
Well, in fact, it's very interesting. Shaving a head does not improve the strength, the vibrancy, the thickness of the hair. And, in fact, if we look at other issues in terms of how people take care of hairs, if we look at their hair, tight ponytails, cornrows, buns, you know, that pull traction on the hair actually cause the hair to fall out, something called traction alopecia. So shaving the head does not make the hair grow thicker, but if you pull on the hair, as some people do, you know, basically with tight ponytails, that makes the hair fall out.
Yeah.
So the answer is let it be.
Yeah.
Let it be. That's the best way to do it. You don't have to shave it and don't pull it too tightly.
If shaving the head really worked, you and I would have been shaving.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'd be shaving every other week, or, you know, I'd just shave my hair, and all of a sudden I'd have a complete set of hair. In fact, that would be great. All of a sudden, all I would do is shave my head. I wouldn't have to use all the chemicals, all the stuff on there. I wouldn't have to have this. I wouldn't have to have that. And, in fact, it would mean there'd be no bald guys in the world. All it would mean was shave your head and start out again.
Think you can stump our favorite family doc? Or do you have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener, joins in now from Logan, Utah. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hello, Dr. Z.
How can we help you?
Well, ever since I was very young, I've been very nearsighted. And about 3 months ago, I decided to have LASIK eye surgery, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been very happy with the results. I see quite well, especially in the mornings. But by about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, my vision starts to get very, very blurry. And my optometrist says it's because my eyes are just drying out. And I'm using a lot of eye drops, but I'm wondering if you have any other suggestions of things I can do to keep my eyes moist and just heal from the surgery.
Well, it really the dryness is really the issue, and it has a lot to do with the blink. And it also has to do with what you're using. So what do you do for a living? Your eyes are drying out. Are you looking at a computer all day?
Some of the day. I'm a music professor, so in the mornings I'm usually getting ready for classes. In the afternoons I teach. I'm also a piano teacher, so when my eyes dry out, it's quite a problem because sometimes I can't see the score and I'm having to look very close.
Of course. No, all of a sudden it's in there. A couple of questions now. What sort of eye drops are you using in your eye? Do you use them during the day or not?
I do. I use them quite often. Mm-hmm. They come in little individual vials. They're preservative-free.
Yeah, okay. And it's an eye drop that is a pharmaceutical-grade eye drop.
Right.
Okay, because that's very important. In other words, the drop you want to use, one of the drops that I tend to recommend is something called Refresh, but there are a number of drops that are on the market. And basically, these are drops that help moisture in the eye. But once again, it has to do a lot with staring and blinking post-LASIK type surgery or even pre-LASIK. So just a few other questions. Do you find this like at 2 or 3 in the afternoon after you've been staring at music for an hour and a half or 2 hours? When do you find it within your work day?
I've never really sat down and analyzed what I've been doing before.
That's what you have to do.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. What I think is probably happening is you get up, let's say you're on the computer or you're looking at music, whatever you're doing. And my prediction is that the first half hour, you're fine. And the second half hour and the third half hour and the fourth half hour, you're not, because over time, your eye is getting drier and drier because you're looking at it, you're staring at it, and you're not blinking.
That makes sense. That seems to be my experience.
Right. And so what you have to do in your day is you have to figure out where are you going to – now it's not that you – first of all, you can look to the side and you can blink 5 or 10 times. You just force yourself. Blink, 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 blink. Tom is blinking, if you could see this right now, and it looks really, really silly. But when you do that, you'll basically begin to take this dry tear that is on the surface of the eye, and you'll get rid of it.
Okay.
And if you literally begin to do that on a periodic basis, you'll find out when you have to do it. It might be, I think my eyes are getting dry, and you blink 10 times. And sometimes you'll say, I'm going to blink and I'm going to put the drops in. But sometimes it's just the blinking that does it.
I'm going to be batting my eyes all the time.
You may be batting your eyes all day, and you may look like a vamp.
Okay.
That's exactly it. You may look like a vamp. Very sexy. Very sexy.
Great. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good luck with it, and thanks a lot for the call. 800-462-7413. On we go, Zorba, to St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hello, Dr. Pastor.
What's up?
I've had a strange phenomenon of recent origin. For the past few years on long flights, I've developed severe nausea. But the strange thing about it is it only happens when I'm flying east. Now, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that that's in any way connected, but I know Dr. Pastor is a great problem solver.
I
have thought about this a lot, and I need his help desperately because In a few days, I'm about to go on another long flight, and I'm not looking forward to it.
Uh-huh. So this happens when you're flying east.
Where are you flying again?
I'm going to be flying to Istanbul.
Oh.
A couple of questions for you. So when we're talking about east-west, we're talking about long international flights, not going from California to New York and New York to California, right? These are long flights.
Right.
They occur in the evening time?
Correct.
Okay. Evening flights. And you get it after you have the meal or?
Yeah, it was after I ate the meal.
I think this probably has something to do with your natural cortisol levels that are off and off when you're flying these long distances. That's what I think. And I do have some very specific suggestions for it. Now, do you put earplugs in your ears and do you wear eye shades, satin eye shades?
No. But I will if you suggest.
I have a few recommendations. First of all, you don't have to eat airplane food. I know it's shocking, but you actually can say no thank you when they want to put a tray in front of you. And my first recommendation is don't eat anything on the airplane until the morning if you want to. Have a nice big meal before you get on the airplane, maybe an hour or two before. You know, make sure that you're full so you're not really hungry at, you know, whenever they serve it on the airplane. And that's the first step. You want to be digested. 2 hours before you want your food to be digested. So you get on the plane, you're not hungry, and you don't have any food. Number two, earplugs in your ear, satin eye shades on your eye. Very important, satin eye shades on the eye, because they will help cut out the light when you're going to sleep and cut out the noise. You can also get one of those expensive noise reduction earphones. Some cost $250, but the ones that cost about $45 or $50 really also work. And they will help sort of stabilize the normal cortisol levels that are going on in your body until you get there. Remember, you've got this light daytime difference that can make a huge issue, and that's what's driving your nausea.
Okay.
And finally, over-the-counter generic Claritin. Take two tablets, not one, two tablets. And what that will do is that will help right or set up the semicircular canals in your ear to keep you from being nauseous. If you want to be sleepier, then just get Dramamine, which is not a bad idea on an airplane if you tolerate it, and you take 50 milligrams of Dramamine before you get on the plane, 1 hour before, or you take Bonine, B-O-N-N-I-N-E, in a generic form, 25 milligrams before you get on the airplane. And that'll make you a little bit sleepy. That'll be even better, and that'll get rid of your nausea. So antihistamines, earplugs, eye shades, and don't eat food.
You are a genius. Thank you so much.
Wait a minute. I've got another suggestion.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Tom's got another suggestion. I'm all ears.
Never fly east. Always go west. Wherever you're headed, always fly west.
There you go. And the world is round. So
that's right. You'll always get there.
That's right. You'll never get sick.
West.
That's right. You'll never get sick. I like it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call.
Thank you.
And Zorba, thank you.
A pleasure, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. And G.G. Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidrum. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0315Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.